Our panel moderator today is Lisa Shapiro. Lisa is chief economist at the New Hampshire law firm of Gallagher, Callahan, and Gartrell. I'm pleased that Lisa is also a member of the advisory board to the New England Public Policy Center. And she has a particular interest in the topic of today because in her spare time, when she's not working for her law firm or advising the New England Public Policy Center, she chairs the Board of Trustees of the New Hampshire Retirement System. So I'm going to turn things over to Lisa.
Thank you. Good afternoon. In your packets, you have a more extensive biography of each of the panels, but I want to make a quick introduction so you can just figure it out, and then we're just going to go right down the line with some brief presentations about what's most important for each of the speakers. So let me start from my right here. Obviously, this is Dick Woodbury. You've just heard his paper. Welcome up here. Then we have Marguerite Young. And Marguerite is the director of the Public Pension Fund Relationships for the Service Employees International Union Capital Stewardship Program. And we heard that T number, that trillion, and Marguerite's program manages $1 trillion in assets. And they represent over 900,000 public sector employees nationally. So I'm very pleased to have you on the panel with us today. Next to her is Jeb Bradley. That was a Freudian slip for another Jeb in our state. Jeb, the New Hampshire people would appreciate that. Jeb Spaulding is state treasurer of Vermont. We're very pleased to have Jeb with us today. He was very intimately involved in reform in Vermont. We're looking forward to hearing that. And he previously served in the Vermont State Senate, where he chaired the Appropriations Committee and several other important money and tax and education committees. Next to Jeb is John Simmons. Moving along to some business expenditure side, John is the executive director of the Rhode Island Public Expenditure Council, and John also has been intimately involved in pension reform in Rhode Island, so we look forward to hearing lessons learned and observations there as well. And John, they manage a broad range of fiscal and public policy issues at their organization. And John previously served as the chief financial officer for the city of Boston. And finally, to our right, coming in for a both national and regional perspective, Catherine Barrett is the senior advisor to the Pew Center on the States. And they work on a variety of topics, and one of them being pension funds and post-employment health benefits. And Catherine is also a correspondent and management columnist for the Governing magazine.
To say, just to start, that I found the Dick's presentation and study really, really fascinating because there is so little that is done about the employment effects of pension benefits and how they work to either attract or retain employees. We looked at it from a different perspective, which is the how pensions are funded. I should say,
Try hitting the space bar.
And one of the things that we did at the Pew Center on the States is we looked at both pensions and retiree health. I think it's important to look at both those things, not only from the funding point of view, but for the effect on the decisions that employees make about retirement. Retiree health benefits vary tremendously from one state to the other. A kind of weird effect is that if you don't offer retiree health benefits, it may be that employees need to decide to stay in their job longer. So that also affects what people do in terms of the decisions they make. Yolanda mentioned before the article in the New York Times and a $3 trillion gap. It is how big the gap is all dependent on the assumptions that you use. So in doing our report, we looked at the assumptions that states actually use, the median rate of return that they currently expect to get is 8%. And with that, there was about $1 trillion gap between what they have on hand and what they need to have for both retiree health and pension benefits. So you can see how important those assumptions are. I'll give you an example, not from the Northeast, but from Utah. Utah last year changed its assumption from 8% to 7.75%. Just that move changed the funding of the pension plan from 101% funded, a lot better than the Northeast states, to 95% funded. So just that little bit. If they had moved to 8.5% funded, they would be, 8.5% interest rate assumption, their funds would be 113% funded. So it's really, really important to look at the assumptions that states make. The other point I wanted to make is that the states really, really differ a great deal from each other. And that we found when we did our study that there are a lot of states that are actually in fairly decent shape. And they run defined benefit plans, and they have funded them consistently over time. They have not raised benefits when they couldn't afford to raise benefits, and they have maintained their funding level. These are the dark blue states, between 91%. The highest we found was 107%. These were all 2008 figures, so before the bulk of the investment drop occurred. And you can also see that the states that are in the worst shape, the ones that we have in white, there are a lot there in the Northeast. Retiree health, you have to look at this in conjunction with retiree health. As I said before, the states, 50% of the states have 95% of the liabilities there. And the liabilities are way more extreme in some places than others. In Connecticut is a very good example. A couple of years ago when we did another study about pensions and retiree health, we looked at the per capita burden in Connecticut, and it was something like $6,224 when you divided it out into the Connecticut population for retiree health. And that contrasts to states like Oregon, South Dakota, North Dakota, where it's less than $100 per capita. So that's just a very extreme difference in what states offer. And the third thing I wanted to say was that you can really see the impact of keeping up with these obligations or not. Every state has to put in a contribution each year. The contributions are calculated by actuaries, and if you don't put in the full required contribution, you slip farther behind, and you slip farther behind each and every year. And each and every year, you have to pay more, or you should be paying more. So this is a chart that we had that looked at the increase in the annual required contributions, and it's increased substantially from $27 billion to $64 billion from the beginning of this decade to 2008. That's a big, big jump, and it is because of a few factors, but the factors are people skipped their contributions. They paid less than they should have, so the amounts the next years got to be bigger. The investment returns went down. And in the beginning of this decade, a lot of states raised their benefits. So that's why you see that. And just one other fact, which is that it matters tremendously whether you are funded or not for what you pay every year. A state like North Carolina that is nearly fully funded is paying 3%, 4% of payroll. Connecticut is paying 35% of payroll. So it makes a huge difference. And I'll end there. Thank you.
And my name is John Simmons, and I work for the Rhode Island Public Expenditure Council. For some who may not know what that is, we are a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization funded by members within the state of Rhode Island. been around since 1932, so we have had a long history. Pensions is one of the issues that we've looked at for a number of years and have done a variety of work on pension issues as they affect the state of Rhode Island. And I do want to thank Yolanda for having the event this morning. It's quite good. It's timely for us in Rhode Island to have taken a step back after having so many years of looking at pension reforms. And I do want to thank Richard for his fine report as well. It gives us a lot of thought now when I go back to Rhode Island to bring this back to some of the policymakers who will be dealing with pension reform in the 2011 year as well. If I may just start off with just as the Pew Institute took a look at a broad spectrum of pension systems across the country, this would be more focused in on one state, and that's Rhode Island, and some of the same issues that were mentioned earlier, and we'll talk through. You'll see this is, as Richard indicated earlier, this is our sort of our structure of how we have constructed our pension system within the state of Rhode Island. You'll see the Schedule A employees were all those hired prior to 2005. Reform came. That's Schedule B. That was around 2005, 2006. The next one is now we have a hybrid schedule, Schedule A, B, which we have mixed them together. We've changed their accumulation of benefits, the time of retirement. If you look at the normal retirement age, you'll see 62, 65, 10. That was one of the more recent changes requiring people to work until the age of 65, any other service under 29 years of service. Anything else would be reduced radically down. We had another change this year in 2011. We changed the COLA provision within Rhode Island. We had an unlimited COLA, 3% on or CPI. The changes occurs capping the COLA on $35,000. So if you make $36,000, you only get the COLA on $35,000. If you make $42,000, it's the same. If you're making $25,000 on your final compensation and pension, you get the COLA on the 25 until you get to the 35. That materially affects teachers and state employees together. Those are all one plan within the state of Rhode Island. We meshed the two. There are two separate parts to the same plan. It does affect differently the teachers versus state employees. State employees' average income on retirement was around $27,000. Teachers was around $45,000. So it had a different impact. But I'd like just to take one moment on the 62, 65, and 10 and just talk about in a different perspective as to the normal retirement age and thinking about the amount to which you are going to be retired. We also wanted to look at the amount of time that you worked for the state. The question comes, should there be someone working for the state over 30, 40, 50 years? What about public safety, which we do have within our system? They have a much earlier retirement age. They can work 20 years and retire almost at any age. And so the question on public safety, is that a sustainable issue over time? But we look at it from a different perspective just on the amount of time you'll have left that you're going to be paid in retirement, but rather what type of employee are you? What's the cost of the employee that you have? Is it a higher amount for someone who's senior? For instance, on the teachers, for instance, about 60% plus of all the teachers within Rhode Island have at least 10 years or more of service. We have a 10-step pay plan, so you're at the top step. We have longevity schedules that go in for both state employees and for teachers. We have a hierarchy of graduations for colleges, et cetera, which seem to come longer through the time. So the employee range is higher for the longer you serve. So the question on human resources is just not the amount of time left or amount of time that we're going to pay you, but the amount of how much time do you work for the state. But you'll see that we did move that number from earlier on, from the 60 to 10, and no time at 28 years of service. We took into consideration the amount of time, and that's the most savings of any of the items on pensions. What this chart does is two things. It shows you what the savings were projected over the three types of changes that occurred. One change that's not here, which had a material effect upon retirement, was health care. In Rhode Island, we changed the retirement age for the health care for retirees, and we made it longer, that you could not collect the full amount of health care paid by the state, shared by the state, if you retired earlier. So we used that component as a controlling factor for when you retired, as opposed to the age to which you retire. But if you look at the far left-hand side, you'll see that is what the savings are. And if you look at the chart on the right-hand side, that is the projected cost increases prior to any of the market changes that occurred recently on the national market. Also, it is in the sense of prior to any experience study Rhode Island postponed the experience study, which was going to occur last year, for another year or two. Experience study will actually go back in and measure the changes that we talked about on the age of retirement. Are people staying longer? Are they retiring earlier? The health care change back last year actually took 1,300 people off of working status for the state of Rhode Island out of 13 to 14,000 employees. So the health care had a much more impact than actually the retirement changes that occurred the year before, where we had very little changes in the numbers of people retiring. The next is the part for Rhode Island in the sense of what is the percent of the operating budget. Currently, it's 5.1% of the operating budget. It goes to 7.8% in the 2015 budget. This is after all of the changes that Rhode Island has gone through over the last 4 or 5 years. We've had 3 pension changes in 4 years. The same thing is on the employer contributions on state. You'll see it goes from 21% to 33%. This is, again, prior to any market changes that have occurred. They will be factored into the next evaluation and experience study. You'll also see the employees' contribution stays flat at 8.75 and 9.5. Our funding status, as was indicated in the Pew report and others, is 61% on state and 60.3%. The next part is the sort of the options, and I wanted to respond to some of the questions in the report. For instance, should we be more neutral on our age, or should we be more consistent with it? We believe that the next wave will come about will be a hybrid plan. Some are familiar with the Federal Employees Retirement System has a hybrid plan. Part of it is a defined contribution. Part of it is a defined benefit plan. So it's a mixture of DC and DB together, but risk is shared only by the employee and not by the employer. So that risk factor, the changing over occurs of it, so it no longer becomes in the sense of when I retire, because I can take it with me, or I leave at least part of my defined contribution, I can move. The others on the COLA changes and the other changes will occur again. We'll be back on that issue. Again, for all of you who know what the fiscal matters for states are in the 2012 year, we'll be moving back to that issue as well. Again, one of the questions that we ask as a human resource system, not just the age of retirement, is are the ability to provide the services effectively if you're looking at public safety? Should you move the age of retirement, say, from 50 to 55 to 60 for public safety? Most of us would say no. But again, if you want to measure the length of time retirement, public safety is going to be one of the issues that will be back. There will be 3 pension systems. One will be for public safety, which will be structured differently. As you know, most can retire 20 years of service, 50% of their pay, health care, COLAs. That will be one set of a pension system that will be in place where you can see in Rhode Island we have really gone after the pension for regular public employees. The next is the ability to attract younger workers. One of the things that we did is a little bit of discussions on the generational issue. Not everybody wants to come to work for the public sector anymore and feel that they're going to have to work 30 or 40 years to collect a retirement, et cetera. They may want something different. So our plan, as you've seen it, pulls people out to 29 years. We keep you there for 29 years, and once we've got you there, you probably are not going to leave unless we change your health care. Pensions are less significant. We do have a large number of people who stay employed for a variety of reasons. One is the sense of a recession, finding alternative or suitable employment, et cetera. And that would be the impact on their current employees, what is the effective system in terms of long-term service. And that ends my presentation.
While my technical assistant gets my presentation ready, let me try a few reactions to people. First of all, sometimes people think that if you read it in the New York Times, it must be gospel. And it's not always the case. That article in the New York Times was based on a study by Mr. Rao, and I encourage anybody to go on Google and look for some responses to it. If nothing else, go to NASRA.org, the National Association of Retirement Administrators, I guess, State Retirement Administrators, I guess is what it is. But they have an analysis done by actuaries from Gabriel Rodar and Smith and Milliman. A group of actuaries got together, and there are some serious questions about the Rao study that was the basis for the New York Times article. And sometimes it's like how you define the problem or challenge that will lead you to what the solution should be. And I think it's careful that we think carefully about that. And I actually look at the situation we're facing now is not so much a big problem as a big challenge. And I agree with pretty much exactly with what the demographic trends that are going forward. And some of the slides I'll show give a backup to Dick's presentation on that. I also think, though, that, you know, if you look at it more like a challenge, you might come to a conclusion that says we don't need to throw it away, but we need to refine it some. And actually, although even though the demographics for Vermont and Maine show we're getting older and older, I can think of one really good idea of how we're going to change that trend line, and I'm not going to share it with this audience because Vermont needs to do it and have a competitive advantage on the rest of our competitive New England states. But there are things we can do to change the reality if you look at it like a challenge. And you need to be careful that we differentiate, realize that both the pension and the retiree health insurance are major challenges, but look at them differently. Like in Vermont, you know, the major unfunded piece is on the retiree health insurance. And just, you know, as a matter of practice for decades, we have paid the insurance premiums on a pay-as-you-go basis. And I think it's fine to say we ought to look at it on a pre-funded basis. But, you know, I have some friends up there that look at it and go, they put the liabilities together and show that, hey, we've got $1 billion of unfunded liabilities out there, which the lion's share of it comes from retiree health care. And then their conclusion is that we need to do away with a defined benefit plan and have a defined contribution plan because the retiree health insurance plan is such a big problem. Well, that going to a defined contribution plan didn't change the dynamics of the health care one iota. So they are big issues, but you need to consider them and look at them one at a time. I also want to make a point that these systems are dynamic, more dynamic than a lot of people think. I mean, people sort of have a feeling that, hey, these defined benefit plans, they are what they are, and you can't change them. And if you can change them, the only thing you can do is for new employees. And I think you're starting to see around the country many states say, well, that conventional thinking may not always be accurate, and there may be things that we can do that actually make changes, not just for new employees, that maintain our defined benefit plan, but try to make them consistent with the kind of demographic challenges and workforce trends that we see coming down the pike. And I'll talk a little bit about what we've done in Vermont in that regard. Obviously, we need to think of pension and retiree health insurance challenges in the larger picture. And some of my friends from Vermont will tell me that sometimes when I'm thinking about the challenge of funding pensions, I got to realize that if people are going to stay in the state workforce longer, that they're at the higher end of the salary scale, and that if they retired earlier, then we might save some on payroll. If they stay on the job too long, then they're not as productive as they were in their younger ages. And I'm not really trying to answer those things, just to say when you look at these issues, you need to consider them as part of a big picture. I also want to sort of make, since I have an audience here, a point about something that has occurred to me recently. I kind of have for years sort of, and I firmly believe this, feel that there is a fundamental difference between the public sector and the private sector. And that the issues that, you know, FASB looked at in terms of mark-to-market accounting and so forth for the private sector, I can understand it. Because when United Airlines or General Motors or any one of those corporations decides to declare bankruptcy, those pension obligations are transferred to the PBGC, and they're shifted to somebody else. I can, at least myself, from a regulatory perspective, say, well, if that's the case, I want to make sure since I don't know when they're going to declare bankruptcy, I want to make sure they're as close to fully funded at any particular time as I can. And therefore, I might not think that smoothing is such a great idea. And you put those things in place, and what it does is it increases the volatility. It encourages more of those private sector companies to say, hey, I can't play in this game anymore, even though the regulations made sense. In the public sector, at least most of our states and hopefully the smaller municipalities in New England aren't going bankrupt anytime soon. And I think that some of the that's why GASB actually looks at the picture a little bit differently. And there are some fundamental differences between public and private, but really it's bigger than that. And that's what I want to just sort of at least give you one person's perspective, that the kind of pension plan you have should reflect the kind of enterprise you're dealing with. And it's not a public-private per se. It's not a labor management issue. I was fairly recently on a panel, and the union representative represented multi-employer plans. And the average tenure of the employee at the employers that these people work for was very short. There was a tremendous turnover in the businesses. In other words, the businesses didn't tend to last that long either. And if you've got a place where businesses are turning over rapidly and employees are turning over rapidly, you might want to have a different kind of pension plan than you are in a state, where in Vermont, you know, like 60% of the state employees and teachers have worked for the state for a minimum of 20 years when they separate from service, and around 40% for over 30 years. And if you have that kind of longevity, and if you're trying to encourage and reward length of service, you might come to a different conclusion on what kind of pension plan you have. So I got to go fast since we want to get to the questions. These won't take me very long. The first one, if I'm going to do this right, this absolutely, for Vermont, shows the same thing that Dick talked about on your left. That's the ratio of active members to retirees in Vermont. The blue is teachers. The red is state employees. Back in 1990. There were a lot more active members compared to the retired members. And that's going down rather substantially. And since until the last couple of years, until recently, I don't think that it was the count of state employees or teachers that was going down. It's what's on the right that's really driving that, and that's the growth in the retiree population, and they tend to live longer. And it's a wonderful thing. If you're on the receiving side and you can receive a pension benefit for longer than you were in the workforce, that's great. This is the estimate of pension, just pension benefit payouts. And what you can see is it starts back there in 2003 and goes out to 2025. It's been going up at about 8.4% a year. That's just the payouts. That's not the employee or employer contributions, but it just shows, you know, what's going on here. As people are living, there are more of them and living longer, the payouts are going up. The red in this one is teachers. The blue is state employees. The green is the change in trajectory on the benefit payouts. This doesn't reflect employee contributions or employer contributions, just the benefit payouts for the teachers on changes that were made this year in Vermont's legislative session. And one reason why it takes a while to have those go into effect is because it doesn't hit people right away. So in terms of the payouts, the actual payouts and benefits, it takes a while. But we have been able to bend the curve, and when you combine that with employee contribution increases, it's rather dramatic results. As a result of the change, the top line is the employer contribution rate. The bottom line is the employee contribution rate. The green on the right-hand side is what happened this year. The employee this is for teachers in Vermont. The employee contribution rate was raised 40%. And the employer contribution rate, if the changes hadn't been made, was the blue line, and it's the green line now. And this employer contribution rate, this is for pension. For teachers, and it goes back to 1995. And what you can see is that during that period, there is some volatility here too, but the employer contribution is in the 8% range. So if I were in Connecticut or whatever that state was, or Rhode Island, where I had 30% employer contribution rates, you know, I might have a different perspective on this too. But my view is that these are dynamic, and we can control and keep our employer contribution rates at a reasonable level. Briefly, Dick mentioned we have made some changes in Vermont in recent years. I'm going to just talk just for a second about what was done this year. We do have a number of members of our state employees board in the room and our state employees union. And a few years ago, we worked to make changes that raised the normal retirement age for state employees. That is in effect. We are going to be doing some more work over this summer and fall looking at other changes we can make. But this past winter, we made some changes for teachers. And the first thing I want to let you know is that we actually were trying to make a somewhat of attempt to address Dick's question about, well, should we be incenting people to stay a little bit longer? The key is, the most important thing I want to say is we raised the retirement age from what was fairly typical of 62 or 30 years at any age. And, of course, what that means is, you know, if you start it after you graduated from college, you can start drawing your full benefit unreduced at like 52. And that seemed a little young. So we went to 65 or rule of 90, the combination of years of service and your age. So for 30 years, you'd have to be 60 to start drawing your benefit, not what a lot of people are doing at 52. But we did it for all of those people that are not within 5 years of retirement. And that generates a question of fairness. But many people feel that the only way you can make these changes is if you only do it for new employees. And in this case, we made the change in the higher retirement age for everybody that was not within 5 years of retirement eligibility as of the 1st of July, that being tomorrow. And we did this with the full cooperation and support of the Vermont National Education Association. You might say, well, how did you do that? Well, because we tried to address some of their concerns and looked at, you know, worked with the numbers. We said, okay, well, if we're asking people to work longer, maybe we ought to allow them to accrue a little bit larger benefit while they're doing it and give them an incentive to stay in the system. So previously, until the changes most recently for state employees and now for teachers, the max benefit was 50%. So we said, okay, if we're encouraging you to stay in longer, maybe it's kind of an indirect, not as strong as some people would like. We said, well, let's let them accrue a little bit larger benefit up to 60%. And then with teachers, we also said, and not only that, if you survive for 20 years, we will increase the multiplier from 1.67 to 2. So that if you're a long-term teacher, you can get a larger benefit and you accrue it a little bit more rapidly in your later years. And that's what it took to get an agreement that everybody felt good about. But my point is, it made amazing changes. On the top, the normal cost, and I know we're a small state, but you get the general idea. The normal cost calculated by the actuary went from $22.8 million for FY11 down to $10.3. So the normal cost was cut in 50%. That's a pretty big change. I won't dwell on this other than to say that if you go down to the third set of numbers, the arc was supposed to be 63.5. With a combination of changes we made, including the employee contribution rate, the ARC was reduced to 48.2. That's a 25% reduction in the ARC first year. We also made changes on retiree health care, where it used to be you'd get 80% after 10 years. You now have to wait till you're 15 years on the job to get 40%, and then it tiers up as you go along in the years. And that also applied to people on the job. In this case, it was to people with less than 10 years of service. So I guess my point there is that I think these defined benefit plans are more dynamic. I think if you look around the country, there's a lot of movement out there, and you can readjust these pension plans without throwing them out. So thank you very much.
I'm assuming people have had enough of slides for the morning. I want to thank the Federal Reserve Bank and Dick Woodbury for his study. I've been asked today to present labor's perspective on the panel, and I know I'm joined in the audience by many trustees and plan participants who I hope will add their thoughts in the comment and questions section. Retirement security for all is a huge priority for our union, the Service Employees International Union. Nearly half of our members benefit from the security of a defined benefit plan, but most of our members who work in some of the lowest paid jobs in our society face a future with no retirement at all. One of our members in New Hampshire that I recently heard about is a good example, I think, of the story that we're trying to understand and tell today. Her name's Barbara. She worked as a public sector nurse in New Hampshire for more than 30 years, retired on a benefit of around $18,000 a year, which is typical in New Hampshire. And she's also doing something that's also relatively typical for people in public service after they retire. They don't just go sit on a lawn chair somewhere. Barbara runs a program called Operation Santa Claus, which she started as a nurse in her extra time, off of work, and continues to do it today, serving more than 1,000 kids each year in need. That's what people do after they retire in public service when they have a defined benefit to rely on. So I think, as Treasurer Spaulding indicated, it's important to put these things into the larger perspective. People here today are asking if the current state of our, given the current state of our country's economy, whether defined benefit pension plans for teachers, nurses, and firefighters can survive. From my perspective in the labor movement, I think we're asking the wrong question. We should be asking, how is it that in the richest country in the world that everyone doesn't have a retirement plan they can't outlive after a lifetime of work? In fact, most people have no retirement plan. As we look at that big bubble of aging demographic, the most recent information from the Employee Benefits Research Institute is stunning. More than half of households have less than $25,000 saved for retirement. 30% have less than $1,000 saved. The average 401k balance for somebody who's 55, and I don't know if this is pre or post the meltdown, it's less than $60,000. I don't know if those numbers scare you, but they scare me a whole lot more than the numbers I saw today. More than 70% of people worry about whether they'll have enough to cover the basics when they're in retirement, but less than half have figured out what that means in terms of real dollars. According to the Boston Center for Retirement Research, at any given time, less than half of private sector workers are covered by employer-sponsored retirement plans. At retirement, about a third of our country's households are dependent solely on Social Security. The experts are right that an adequate retirement is based on 65 to 80% of annual earnings. We're on the verge of a generation of older Americans, that 35%, 40% in Vermont, retiring in poverty once they can no longer work. Do the math. The Pew Center's estimated $1 trillion gap, or even Professor Rao's larger gap in proper funding levels for public plan pales in comparison to the larger gap that these statistics suggest exist in the private sector. This is the problem that we should be addressing. That's the impact of aging on retirement security that should have us all extremely worried, that the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston should be studying, and the problem we would be well served to turn our attention to. Were it not for the economic meltdown, I doubt we'd actually be here today. How is it that the financial crisis of 2008 and the ensuing Great Recession have resulted in record profits for the banks, but have had dire results for the rest of us? The crisis has wreaked havoc on family wealth through foreclosures and 401k meltdowns. It's triggered unemployment levels, levels not seen since World War II, that will continue. We see no end in sight. It has stretched state and local budgets so thin that they can't provide needed services, which are increasingly in greater demand and will be as that population ages. And it's left pension funds, just like others trying to figure out how to plan for retirement, recovering despite their pre-funded levels before the crash at 80% or more. It's our boom-bust economy that's unsustainable, not the retirement plans offered to public employees. The real underlying problem is that state and local governments don't have the capacity that they need to address society's demands for quality public services, service demands that will increase dramatically as our population ages. Let's not fix pensions only to find that we've addressed the wrong problem. Mr. Woodbury's paper posits the idea of age-neutral retirement policies such as 401ks. He says there's no implicit incentive for employees to choose retirement at any particular time. Actually, I think he's right. As anyone who's found her 401k melt down into a 201k in the blink of an eye, choosing retirement at any age may never be an option. In contrast, defined benefit pension plans have been extraordinarily successful and for the most part cost-effective in helping to recruit, train, and retain a skilled workforce. Treasurer Spaulding gave some great examples of the average tenure of teachers in Vermont as an example. They've provided superior returns to 401k plans at a much lower cost, as much as 20% less to get a comparable benefit. They've also assured an orderly turnover of the workforce and provide that workforce with an adequate retirement that can't be outlived. It's true, they aren't age neutral, but they are age proof, and that's a good thing. Switching to defined contribution plans in the public sector would only reward the Wall Street bankers who wrecked our economy. That's a bad thing. But what should we be doing about the stress that our cities, counties, and states are facing and that our members are facing as they look to trying to figure out how to keep doing the jobs that they've been hired to do? We need to work together. I agree with Treasurer Spaulding and others who've said this needs to be a collaborative effort. And where it has worked, it has been a collaborative effort to figure out how we get through this bulge. We face a steep mountain to climb, thanks to Wall Street, to get our pensions back on a sustainable footing. What the Pew Center graph didn't show was the range of contributions prior to the last crash. We're on this kind of a curve with pension contributions because of the economy. 65% of the money that pensions depend on comes from investments. So the volatility in the markets is going to determine the volatility in those employer contributions, much more so than benefit levels. But do we need new rules of the road, refinements, as Treasurer Spaulding suggested? I think so. I think we'd all agree. I've got some simple rules, ones you might have heard on the schoolyard. Number one, no cheating. Pensions should reward a career in public service with a stable lifetime income based on final average salary. But you shouldn't be able to get paid more in retirement by bending the rules right before you leave. You also shouldn't be able to retire on Friday and return to the same job as a consultant on Monday, as many top-level managers do. Most of our members don't have that option. Second, sharing. Pension funding is a shared responsibility. Each and every paycheck from nurses, teachers, and firefighters includes a pension contribution. But our boom-bust economy has resulted in volatile funding requirements and behavior as a result of other financial pressures by employers. Holidays in good times, huge bills in bad times, and sometimes foregoing payments in bad times when they're most needed. Employers and employees should both pay what's necessary to assure plan health all the time. Third, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. In the last 10 years, and going back further, investors have been fooled into thinking that asset bubbles would never burst. Many of our pension funds underestimated risk in their real estate and private equity portfolios or believed those hawking risk-free super returns in the public markets. But just like those of us who started to believe that we could really turn our houses into gold, we should have learned that lesson by now. Fourth, we need to play fair. There are the cases of former pension fund trustees, staff, elected officials, and others using their position and influence for personal gain in the pension funds has to end. And finally, we need to work together. As long as retirement security is a disappearing concept for most people in the United States, retirement security for those of us that work as teachers, nurses, firefighters, foster care workers will continue to be under attack. What can we do to make sure that everyone has a secure retirement? Our union and others are actively joining with other private sector and non-union workers to fight for a national secure retirement plan for all people in addition to Social Security. Groups like Retirement USA are tackling this issue and deserve our support and encouragement. Over the last 30 years, the rich and the financial sector in particular have both profited, while the standard of living for average middle-class folks has plummeted. They took our jobs, our good schools, our health care, our public services, our access to higher education, and for most of us, our retirement security. Now they're coming after the few people that still have a hope of retiring and not living in poverty. If you don't think this is an ideological attack, you are wrong. SEIU invites all of you to join us in standing up to Wall Street and the corporate bullies and demand that they pay their fair share of taxes, bring good jobs back into our communities, pay their workers a fair wage, and provide them a retirement with dignity. That's the right fight. If we as a country don't wage it, not only will our police, teachers, and firefighters lose their retirement security, we'll lose our whole way of life. Thank you.
Thank you very much for all those comments. Yolanda asked me to kick this off with a few questions, and then we'll take it to the audience from there.